So it was a weird, sometimes wild, sometimes wonderful World Cup qualifying cycle that ultimately ended with the U.S. men's national team qualifying for Qatar. But I think now is as good a time as ever to kind of take a look back on this World Cup qualifying cycle and kind of see how we got here from there. In order to do it, we're going to bring in a guest who is a fan favorite on the Yank Report, one of our all-time favorite guests. She is Meg Swanick. She is a reporter covering the U.S. men's national team game. U.S. men's national team, she was at all but one World Cup qualifier, so she's going to hopefully be able to give us some insights that you can only pick up from being at the game, in the stadium, in the town before the game, and in the press conferences whenever some of these dramatic moments took place. So, Meg, thank you for coming on. How's Costa Rica?
Costa Rica is hot, beautiful, a bit rainy in the afternoon, but enjoying my time here.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, Meg was at the game in Costa Rica and she hasn't left. She's enjoying it so much. And I think you could tell with some of the weather coming in through the window that she's in a nicer place than Louisiana where I am right now. All right, so let's jump in. First game of World Cup qualifying. I remember this as the players coming out with all kinds of bravado, talks of a 9-point window. That's all we heard. There was a ton of confidence. One of the big things coming into this window was this big discussion was finally kind of coming to fruition where is experience going to matter in World Cup qualifying away? How much of the players having experience in big European games is going to impact a CONCACAF away game? And then ultimately they get to El Salvador. And I've heard from some of the people who were there, some of the other reporters, that this atmosphere in El Salvador was probably the most intense atmosphere of all the away games and all of World Cup qualifying. What do you remember about coming into this game and the ultimate aftermath?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I was thinking about this myself, you know, which atmosphere being, so I missed one game, but it was a home game. I was at all of the away games. And I think by far the game at El Salvador had the most energy to it. The crowd was incredible. Credit to them. El Cuscatlan is an incredible stadium atmosphere to be in. And I actually asked this question to Walker Zimmerman as he was coming out of the celebration, just having qualified for the World Cup. And I said, what atmosphere was the most intimidating? And he said, without question, El Salvador. And he said Costa Rica second to that, interestingly.
Yeah, that's what I heard as well from some other podcasts and people who were there talking about it, that it was El Salvador and then Costa Rica. Now, one of the things, of course, one of the big themes that's going to impact all of World Cup qualifying was this idea that a lot of the players had never played in World Cup qualifying, and there was a lot of confidence going in that they were going to take it like any other game. Now, since World Cup qualifying is over, some of the players have admitted that they were not ready for the intensity and that it was a little bit more than they were expecting. Can you kind of tell me about what you were seeing in the eyes of the players and the confidence before the game and then kind of what you were hearing in the press post-game press conference? Football might be over, but MLS is coming back and Champions League and European soccer are in full swing. From all the latest odds, totals, player performance props to where the next fired coach is going to land, BetOnline is the number one spot for all your sports betting needs. Head over to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today and receive 50% off your welcome bonus on your first deposit. Just use promo code BELIEVE to get started. And it's not just basketball. BetOnline is your source for hockey, boxing, and UFC odds, right to the Olympic coverage, from sports right down to your favorite Vegas casino games. BetOnline is your number one online wagering destination. BetOnline, the fastest and easiest way to wager on all your favorite sports and play all your favorite games. BetOnline, where the game starts.
Yeah, and I think it's worth thinking about what we were coming off of going into that game in El Salvador. We had had an incredible summer where we had just won two big tournaments in the Nations League and in the Gold Cup. The team was feeling really confident. You know, we've had players playing all over Champions League, winning trophies, getting transferred to big teams abroad. I think there was, as you said, a ton of confidence. There was also, not just from the players, but from Greg Berhalter, an expressed interest in really making a mark and in coming out, not just qualifying for the World Cup, but coming number one, getting 9-point windows, going away to games in El Salvador and Honduras and playing the way that we wanted to play rather than adapting to what the conditions or the team needed of us. And that was something that I think quickly changed over the course of that first window, not just that first game in El Salvador. But you could see in that first game in El Salvador specifically that, you know, in that 0-0 draw, you know, you had players like Conrad or Serginho Dest trying to, you know, make big moves or go for these, you know, fancy dribbles and just getting like tackled literally American football style, or just, you know, not working out. So I think that it was a bit of a rude awakening that first game. And then obviously Canada as well wasn't the result that we wanted. They were sitting back. That really threw us. And then the game in Honduras was a disaster in the first half, salvaged miraculously in the second half. So I think they quickly did an about face ahead of the second window. They were singing a much different tune. And then all of a sudden you heard them say game by game instead of.
Yeah, you're getting a little ahead of me right now. I want to stick to the aftermath of this El Salvador game, because that was bad. And then things got worse, as you kind of alluded to. Gio Reyna goes down in that game, and that's the last we would see him until the last window of World Cup qualifying. Conrad De La Fuente, I think that was his only minutes of World Cup qualifying, were in that game. That was the last time we saw Brendan Aaronson as a midfielder. And I think that was the last time we saw Serginho Dest as a left back. But then we thought, you know, we're going back home. We're going to go to Nashville. We're going to get right against Canada. This is a Canada team that we had beaten in the Gold Cup not too long ago. We were still confident going in. And then we get the news that Weston McKennie is not going to be with the team against Canada because of something that happened that we still don't even know all the details around. But he broke a team rule and he was no longer going to be with the team. And this is whenever kind of the anxiety started to really heighten within the U.S. men's national team fan base. And that post-game press conference for that Canada game was brutal. What do you remember about that?
Yeah, etched in my memory is Christian Pulisic coming into that room, almost like shuffling his feet with his head down. You could feel, I think I said this to you before, and this has been said elsewhere already, so, but it bears repeating, just the energy coming off of him. You could tell he had this oh no feeling and the pressure of making sure that we didn't repeat what had already happened. I think that was my biggest takeaway. And then that combined with Greg coming into, you know, I think Tyler was also in that post-match press conference, and he was a little bit defensive or feeling a little bit feisty almost, which I like from him. And I think we get that consistently from him. Greg also had an aura of not panic, I would say, but realization of where
he was shook. That was the most different Greg Berhalter that we've seen throughout World Cup qualifying. That was the most shook I've ever seen him.
Yeah, I think he knew that he had to go to Honduras and get 3 points and do it with, you know, enthusiasm. Otherwise, his job was at stake, and you could tell in that press conference.
Yeah, I remember that being the press conference where Christian Pulisic said, "We need new ideas," and that was kind of adding fuel to the fire that what's going on in this locker room. Are the players still believing Greg Berhalter? Is he even going to be the coach throughout World Cup qualifying? And there was a lot riding on that Honduras game. I mean, there was a lot of folks calling for his head. And even at halftime during the Honduras game, I remember the broadcast on Paramount Plus with like Aguchi Onyewu and Clint Dempsey and Charlie Davies. Those guys were openly saying, you know, if the U.S. doesn't come back, there's going to be some real questions about Greg Berhalter. Now, going into that game, the U.S. puts out that wild lineup where there's three in the back, and it's just really disjointed. It's not looking good. Greg makes a bunch of changes at halftime. He pulls off John Brooks, and that would be the last time we saw John Brooks throughout World Cup qualifying. But it wasn't just John Brooks. Yeah, I'm sorry. John Brooks, that was Tim Ream's last window with the team, I believe, as well. And that game, that was the entry of Ricardo Pepi, the first time we saw him. That was his breakout performance. And that game sort of, there was a lot of changes that were made after that. But kind of what were your thoughts on getting away from that game, feeling kind of relieved, feeling like Greg may have saved his job at that point, and that at least they didn't throw away qualifying in the first window?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the premonition that the players and the media and U.S. soccer apparatus around them felt after the El Salvador and Canada game was congealed in that first half in Honduras. People were already planning out what they were going to say to the media, or, you know, what are we going to do now? Kind of thinking ahead past that second half. They salvaged it. Credit to Greg. He made the right subs. Credit to the players. They got it together and they kept, you know, they've turned the game around in that second half. But I think that they definitely, you know, coming out of the locker room, going to the team bus after that game, still looked unhappy with themselves and the way that they played and the performance that they wanted from themselves in that first window. And I think if they thought maybe this isn't going to be as easy as we thought, or not that they ever thought it would be easy, but if this isn't going to be you know, this isn't going to be the way that we thought it would be. It was congealed in that game against Honduras.
So we'd have to wait a month until the next game. And in the next window, we get Jamaica at home, Panama away, and then Costa Rica at home. Now, as you kind of alluded to earlier, coming into that window, there was no more 9-point window. It was now take it one game at a time. And I believe this was the first time we started hearing the word verticality, or at least we started hearing it with the amount of frequency that we did in that window. And I really feel like this window was the turning point for the national team stylistically. We stopped seeing John Brooks. We stopped seeing Tim Ream, the more possession center backs. We get more Miles Robinson. We get Chris Richards, Walker Zimmerman in that window. The U.S. stops kind of trying to play it out of the back as much, and it's straight down the field. It's vertical. It's more direct. The first game in that window is Jamaica. I know you weren't at that game, but kind of what were your thoughts about seeing such a drastic change in the approach from the first game of the first window to the first game of the second window?
Well, I think that, as you alluded to, there was a big personnel shift from that first window to that second window. In that first window, we had a mix of some veterans like Tim Ream, like you said, or John Brooks as well, who were assumed to be de facto parts of the roster, if not the starting lineup, that we wouldn't see again after that, after those performances in the first window. I also think you had some holdovers from Gold Cup and from, you know, traditional Greg favorites, as they say, like Sebastian Legette or Christian Roldan, who were the go-to subs or the starters in that first window, getting moved into a different role, starting with that second window, even more so in the third, but starting in that second window. And then we had players who had been injured or who weren't available in that first window coming in that second window against Jamaica, and then in the matches following. And I think, you know, I forget who you just said, you mentioned a few of them, but Yunus Musa is a big one for me. He wasn't with us that first window, same with Tim Weah. And I think the factor of those two, also with Weston McKennie coming back, were huge factors in that verticality, which it's hard to imagine a time when we weren't hearing that word all the time. But I think you're right that that's when it was really getting driven home to us. The other thing I would say about that Jamaica game is Ricardo Pepi. And this is when, you know, in retrospect, I wonder if we put too much pressure on him. But this is when, you know, he was the story of the United States men's national team. Everybody was so excited by his performance with FC Dallas, and then coming into that game in Honduras, playing a role, I think, in maybe all, either in the buildup or in the actual assisting goal, all of the goals that we scored against Honduras, if I remember correctly. And then obviously had a big game in Jamaica and in home state of Texas. And we all just fell in love with the, not just the play of Ricardo Pepi, but also the story of Ricardo Pepi. I mean, if you go back and you look at the headlines and the things people were saying, it's almost over the top. And I think, it was an exciting time, and I also wonder if, in retrospect, we started to put too much pressure and expectation there as well.
Yeah, I could see that. I look at this Jamaica game in a lot of ways as sort of the first time we see the U.S. men's national team that we've kind of come to know now. It was the first time we saw the MMA midfield in World Cup qualifying, and it was really exciting. We thought that, well, I mean, we really did find a lot of answers in midfield in that window, and seeing Pepi emerge was really exciting as well. Now, one of the themes of World Cup qualifying is going to be a lot of excitement followed by massive disappointment, and that's what we found going away to Panama. So you were at this game in Panama. It was a game in which Greg had a major rotation following the Jamaica game. We had like George Bello was on the field in that game. Mark McKenzie was on the field. Sebastian Legette started. Paul Areola started. Giassi Zardes started. And the U.S. underwhelmed and ended up getting beaten Panama 1-0, I believe, off of a Giassi Zardes own goal. So what do you remember from that post-game press conference and just everything coming out of that game?
Yeah, a few things. I think that solidified the departure of a few players. Sebastian Legette sticks out in particular. And I think something that we really lacked was the verticality that you just mentioned and that we were seeing in that Jamaica match. I would also say that I think for all the talk of the depth that we do have in the United States men's national team, I think that we saw an example of where we didn't have it, where we thought we might have, at least in the players who we thought were the go-to depth for the team. So I think it was a reassessment of the depth that we thought we had and who was filling in those positions. Greg overplaying his hand, thinking we could go away. You know, Panama is a tough team. It's always been a tough team. Playing away in Panama is going to be a tough game. I think that he really made a tactical misstep thinking that he could rotate that heavily with the players that he rotated and still have the result that we wanted coming out of that. But, you know, again, like you said, I think there's always a positive and negative to all of this. And I think that while that game was really disappointing and would, you know, put some pressure in upcoming windows, I think that Greg did adjust and he did not repeat that specific mistake.
Yeah, I think that game was the last time we saw George Bello play. I think Anthony Robinson played every minute from there on out in World Cup qualifying, I believe. And I believe that was the last time we saw Sebastian Legette get minutes, and I think Martin McKenzie as well. So there was a lot of players that were part of that window and a part of that game that just went away. And I think an interesting thing, now that you mention it, it kind of brings back this memory, is a lot of people in the fan base and in the media were very critical of Sebastian Legette in that game and Berhalter's implementation of Sebastian Legette. And Berhalter, I believe in a podcast with Bobby Warsaw, kind of alluded to the fact that he didn't get what he wanted out of some players, but he never actually named names. He was never actually direct with his criticism. And I think that's sort of a theme with Berhalter throughout his tenure, is he's never really been overtly critical of any of the players. Is that something you've come to find with Greg throughout qualifying?
You have to really push. And I think that, you know, we finally saw some tangible feedback on John Brooks after a lot of questions. You know, I think that there's a lot of rightful critiques of the media for questions that aren't always asked, but they also aren't always answered. And I think you really do have to push. And it was only after like the third or fourth media member asked that same question in the same press conference that he answered it. And I think that makes sense, you know, from a management perspective. The players are going to hear this. It's going to get back to them. I think that he doesn't want to give that specific critique, but you can read between the lines and kind of get a sense for who he's talking about.
Yeah, it's interesting because coming out of that game, a lot of people were upset that Greg didn't like rip Sebastian Legette right there. But yet that was the last time he had any impact in World Cup qualifying. Even though he was brought into the next window, he didn't play. So it's just interesting the way that Greg's handled his business in that way. The next game would be Costa Rica at home. This was a game in which the U.S. went down early to Costa Rica and ended up scoring two goals. One before halftime, that incredible Serginho Dest strike, and then the last one with Tim Weah. I think interesting things from this particular game was it was the first time I think Greg put out that a lineup that the fans really loved. Part of that was Paul Arriola was supposed to go, but he got injured before the game. So Tim Weah comes on. And it really was the beginning of the emergence of Tim Weah as a player that really pulled the U.S. offense through the mid part of World Cup qualifying. He went from kind of an option to being the guy in the attack, especially in that moment where Gio Reyna was out and Christian Pulisic was out. So a big game from the U.S. and kind of what was the feeling following that game whenever the U.S. was able to come from behind and beat Costa Rica?
Yeah, Lower.com Field is an incredible atmosphere, it must be said, first of all. Brand new stadium, the crowd is really enthusiastic. It's interesting to look back, going from that first window to that second window, to think about the players who weren't de facto starters or weren't, you know, presumed to have the role that they would end up playing. I think you mentioned Anthony Robinson already from the last match as one of them. I think that was one. I think Tim Weah is another, and it started kind of with an accident, like you said. Because the other thing to think about is these accidental injuries or things like that that keep players out. I mean, Walker Zimmerman, I think, was it this window that he wasn't going to get called in, and then Tim Ream had a personal thing he was working on, and then Walker Zimmerman comes in. I think that was the second window.
You might be correct. That sounds correct.
Yeah, so, you know, these accidents of circumstance, whether it's injury or family stuff, that gives the opportunity to somebody who ends up being kind of irreplaceable over the course of qualification. I think Tim Weah is one, and this is kind of when he made that big debut. I think that he had a hand in that second goal. They might have kept it as an own goal in the end, but I attribute it to him in my head. you know, in the other thing I'll say after the Panama game, and it has to be said, is it's not just Sebastian Legette who kind of was completely phased out after that, but Mark McKenzie as well. And, you know, Greg Berhalter could have been talking about him not getting what he wanted out of him in that center back position. He was called in after that, but I don't think we've seen him after that. And then the other one is Matt Turner. So Matt Turner, and he has said this recently in an interview on Jimmy Conrad's podcast, that after the Panama game, he was, you know, Greg or coaching staff talked to him, and they said that, you know, that was not your best performance, but also we're going to go with Zach kind of from here forward, given where he plays, given the caliber of his training day in and day out. So I think it was interesting that as of that Costa Rica game, this is when Zach became the de facto starter moving forward in qualification. And I don't know that over the course of the full game in Costa Rica, he was tested that much, but, you know, obviously there was that early goal, which, you know, it happened almost as soon as the game started. I think he looked rusty. He looked like I'm a big fan of Zach. And, you know, I think he has a lot of merit to being the starting goalkeeper. But when the game that he took that starting position, I think it's worth pointing out that he looked like a keeper who wasn't starting at his club. So that was something that sticks out to me about that Costa Rica game as well.
I think it's fair to ask, after the first window, I know you and I had a discussion after that window, and a lot of that discussion surrounded the strength of the team, the strength of the team in the locker room, and whether Greg had the faith of the team. There was, you know, we pointed to the comments Christian Pulisic made. We pointed to kind of the demeanor that some of the players had in the post-game press conferences, the demeanor some of the players had on the field, some of the demonstrative motions some of the players had towards the coach in that Honduras game and in that Canada game. After the second window, what was kind of your sense of the strength of the group and the unity in the locker room following that second window?
I would say somewhere close to where it is now, which is that I think they respect Greg. And I think that they see him as kind of a manager of the team and that he got the job done. I think that whereas things felt more tense after those first three matches, potentially it wasn't as tense after the sixth. And so there wasn't mutiny and people aren't, you know, rallying to have him removed, at least of the players called into camp. The broader pool of players might feel a bit differently, especially if you're on the edge and feel like you should be in camp. But I also don't know then or now that players feel motivated or compelled by Greg the way that Canada, for example, does by John Herdman. I think you can tell from the way the players talk about him in press conferences that they admire him, that Herdman motivates them. I don't get that sense then or now from the players with Greg, but I would say that they see him as someone who got the job done after that second window and into now.
All right, well, let's move to that November window because that was huge. I mean, the U.S. was taking on Mexico. It was going to be the first time the U.S. played Mexico from the Gold Cup. It was a big moment, and it was seen as one, you know, because the U.S. had dropped some points earlier in World Cup qualifying. It was a game that the U.S. had to win on U.S. soil. And it was also a big game for El Tri, kind of an opportunity for them to show that they're still the big dogs in town. And it was a big result. The U.S. ended up getting that 2-0 victory. Kind of tell me about what you remember from that game, kind of going into that game, the tenseness of it, and then ultimately the excitement, the Christian Pulisic with the man in the mirror celebration, and just all that came from that game.
Yeah, legendary evening, all things considered. Just a funny anecdote. So in the press box, just how, you know, it was an enormous press box and just where they had us sitting, I was sitting surrounded by Mexican press members. And so it was funny to be sitting there throughout the match with them. And I have just these funny memories of, like, I think Yunus Musa dove a few times and they would be like, Teléfono La Liga, Señor, kind of thing. And, you know, just comments they were making about Pepe anytime that he touched the ball was funny. And then right before Christian Pulisic went in, they were like, ¿Dónde está Captain America? And then he went in and scored, and we were just like joking with each other. So it was fun to be in the press box with the Mexican media. They've got a good presence there. But in terms of the game, I think that was probably throughout World Cup qualifying the most convincing we've ever looked, the most dominant we've ever looked in playing the way that we've said we wanted to play and executing that. I think that individual game performances, some players had their best games. I think, again, Tim Weah was looking incredible. Christian was coming off of an injury, and so we were unsure how exactly he was going to be used. He ended up coming in that quote-unquote super sub position and making an impact immediately. Yeah, just an incredible game, and I think that that's the strongest that we looked. And I think we can get a few things out of that. I mean, it's incredible how this team can rally around a big opponent, how the pressure of playing Mexico kind of gets them to their top performance, at least at home. And I'd like to see that more consistently with other opponents, because I don't know that we always have. But I would say that that's the most compelling we've ever looked, especially in that second half.
Yeah, absolutely. I would totally agree. And just, I mean, everything that emanated from that with Christian just looking as cheeky as ever in the post-game press conference and just being really coy about his choice of celebration, and just everything was, the vibes were high, as the kids would say. But they didn't last very long, because the U.S. would then have to go to Jamaica. And once again, it was a letdown on the road. This particular game, no Weston McKennie, no Miles Robinson. So the U.S. had to bring in, I believe, Jean-Luc Abusio started that game. Yeah. The U.S., after a big early goal from Tim Weah, where he really kind of put the team on his back and scored one, the U.S. was kind of holding on for dear life for the rest of that game. It was a weird game at Kingston, where the crowd wasn't huge, it didn't seem like, on TV. But the U.S. kind of get bailed out in the end with some favorable calls and kind of limped away, kind of happy about a draw, but just not what they were hoping for after such a big result against Mexico.
Yeah, it's amazing what happens to this team when Weston McKennie is not there. I mean, I think arguably he's the most important player in a lot of ways to the team. One thing I'll say, and I don't want to be, you know, overly harsh in driving this home, but beyond being inconsistent, I think that sometimes this team gets rattled easily. And when they go down, especially on the road, or when there's an equalization on the road, they don't always rally the way that I think that they can. And I think that they need big players like Weston McKennie to kind of step up and provide that energy or that spurt going forward. And it doesn't always happen. And we didn't see it in Jamaica. I mean, I think we have a handful of players that can provide that, but we weren't seeing it in Jamaica. And it is a pattern over time.
Do you contribute that to like a lack of experience, lack of older players on the squad that can rally the troops and get them going?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I think, you know, going back to the Mexico match with the Christian Pulisic celebration, it sounded like it was DeAndre Yedlin and Tim Weah who had done that. And it's, you know, very clear, I think, that those two, who are very close to one another, provide a lot of the energy in the locker room before games, at halftime, after games. I mean, DeAndre Yedlin said to the media in the last window that at the halftime of the Panama game, he had been somewhere else for some reason, and he went into the locker room and he said it was like a funeral in there. And so he kind of just like went around slapping people and getting the energy back up. And I think he is really key to the team. I think Weston McKennie is really key to the team in providing that energy and that leadership. And I don't know that all of the players have that quite yet. I think it's a mix of things. I think it's partly just personality, because I think Weston McKennie provides that. I think Tim Weah can provide that energy coming in with his boombox, you know, really trying to push the game forward. So it's a mix of personality as well as veteran leadership, I think.
Yeah, and I think that point got really driven home in the latest Behind the Crest video that U.S. Soccer put out, where DeAndre Yedlin actually gave like a pregame speech that they caught on video and put in that montage prior to the Costa Rica game. So you can see that, you know, he is that guy that's going to get up there and give that speech to the team. I mean, it was quite moving if you haven't seen it, because he talked about, you know, there's not many times in life where you get a second opportunity at a missed chance. And, you know, he was with the team that lost in Cuba, and he's getting this opportunity to right that wrong. And he was thanking all the players for letting him have that. And it was just a really cool moment. And you could tell that DeAndre Yedlin is that guy to this team in this locker room. And it's really interesting.
Yeah, I think he's an intangible for that reason. And it's really obvious that he's like the energy, the heart behind the team in a lot of ways. I haven't watched it yet, though. I'm excited to see it.
Yeah, so the next window would be in January, and this was probably the most controversial window of all of World Cup qualifying. This was the cold window. This was where the U.S. Played Canada, but they also decided to play two games at some of the coldest places that they could pick. The first one was home to El Salvador. Where was that? That was in Ohio somewhere.
Columbus again.
The third time. It was the game. This was a game where I remember Jesus Ferreira missed that big opportunity. The U.S. really controlled the game against El Salvador, created some big chances, but weren't able to put them away. The anxiety of the U.S. not having a reliable finisher was definitely present, and the fans were quite upset with Greg Berhalter kind of pointing to XG in the post-game press conference, which I think would become a theme with this squad and with Greg Berhalter. But what do you remember about that El Salvador game?
Yeah, I mean, I think all the things that you just said, and this might seem like a small anecdote, but going back to Ricardo Pepi, and I think that this is one of the biggest questions I have now post-qualification is what we're going to do with our inability to have a reliable striker who's consistently in form. And I think Ricardo Pepi, we were so high on him after that second and that third window. He got that big transfer. I think that, I mean, this was early days. He was just getting there at this point, but he wasn't playing for us. I mean, he didn't feature in that game. And after the final whistle blew, he wasn't with the team kind of celebrating or going over to thank the fans. And he had his head hanging down and he was kind of trudging across the field. And one of the coaches came over and kind of put their arm around him. It's nothing to do with the match, but I kind of think one thing that just sticks in my head specifically about that game is that image. And I feel like from there forward, Ricardo Pepi never entirely got his footing back. And I think that he is kind of feeling the pressure, feeling frustrated at not getting the opportunity to prove that he can still perform like he had been in October, November because of playing time. So that's one small thing. I mean, I think we could have done better in that match, especially given that it was a home match with an incredible atmosphere. But yeah, really forgettable performance overall, I would say.
And then we move on to the big away match against Canada that the fans were really looking forward to. The U.S. ended up losing that game 2-0 in Canada. It was very cold, not as cold as the next match would be, but it was very cold. And the U.S. had another game where it was really frustrating. The U.S. had a lot of possession. They were unable to create many scoring opportunities. It was kind of the same theme that we've seen throughout World Cup qualifying, where the U.S. struggles to break down teams whenever they're sitting back. In the post game, I mean, this game is going to be remembered for the post game interview that Greg did, where I forget the exact words, but he said something like, "We dominated the game."
The most dominant performance ever.
Yeah, yeah. Now, eventually, later after that window, he was asked about that by Bobby Warshaw, and he said that speaking more to the players in the locker room because they had a game that they had to go out and win. The next game was going to be majorly important. So it gave kind of an insight about how Greg Berhalter sort of approaches talking to the media. Sometimes whenever he's talking to the media, he's actually talking to the players, and he's pretty... he chooses his words carefully, I guess you could say. But what do you remember about that Canada game?
I think that, I mean, first of all, I'm excited for Canada that they've qualified. I'm excited that, you know, they're back and they're a big competitor. And I think that they're a fun team to watch. I think in a lot of ways, they had the run through qualification that the United States wished that they had. And I think that maybe... Yeah, I don't know. I think that we really need to figure out how to create more chances, especially when we're playing a team in a low block. I think that you're absolutely correct that sometimes Greg is talking to the players when he's speaking to media, but all the same, he makes other comments that are kind of shocking, you know, whether that's being surprised to find a low block, whether he's trolling the media or, you know, trolling the fans on Twitter, comments that he might see. You know, you see that elsewhere where, like, after going back to the first Canada game, in the post-match right off the side of the field, Brendan Aaronson is, you know, giving an interview and it sounds like he was surprised to find them in a blow block. So you kind of wonder, well, are you not preparing for that when you play a team like Canada? And I still have those questions after that second time that we played them. We didn't come up with a way to break that down. I think that was disappointing. I also think that, you know, their goals were preventable to a certain extent. And I think that we, you know, as we start to play higher caliber teams, we're going to get punished by even wider margins of a scoreline if we don't, you know, clean up some of our mistakes in the back, whether that's from the goalkeeper or from the center backs, and capitalizing on the few opportunities that we have. So I think in both directions, there's things to work out from that match, and we really need to figure out what to do with a low block because it's, you know, leaving CONCACAF, we're going to see it. You know, Iran's probably going to play in a low block, maybe. We're going to see it again. We haven't figured out how to create in that type of game.
You mentioned your excitement for Canada, and I'm curious your thoughts on Canada's performance in World Cup qualifying. I know they drew a pretty tough draw in the World Cup, but permit me to dive into XG land for a second there. Canada did benefit pretty well from XG. I mean, I believe they let in fewer than their XG goals against, and they scored more than their XG goals. So if you're playing that out, maybe it's not a large enough sample size, but it seems like Canada overachieved a little bit compared to what the expectation was. Now, a lot of that's due to having some pretty phenomenal strikers and pretty phenomenal goal scorers up top. But what did you think about Canada? Do you think that they performed up to a team that should be number one in CONCACAF? Do you think they got a little bit of a benefit here and there? How do you think that they're going to be performing moving forward within this region?
Well, I think they're going to be strong into the future. I think that, you know, they're not going to disappear by any means after that. Do I think that they are, you know, there's a lot of talk about talent on paper and in practice. Do I think that they're the most talented on paper? No, I think that they have a few world-class, well, at least one world-class player. They have a few players who are the best in CONCACAF, maybe even three players who are the best in CONCACAF at their position. Outside of that, they have strong players, but they wouldn't be at the top of the CONCACAF player in that position, from my perspective. So they have a small handful of people who can really capitalize and finish and perform better than anyone else can in their positions. But I think that they have all of the intangibles. And so I think that that is part of why they performed as well as they did. I think they have the identity, they have the passion, they want to perform for Canada. They know that they're bringing Canada back to the World Cup for the first time since 1986. They've got a coach who, I mean, sitting in press conferences with John Herdman, I feel like I could beat everyone else in CONCACAF. I can't imagine how Alphonso Davies or Jonathan David feel listening to him, kind of thing. So I think that they've got all of the intangibles coming together. They've got the passion, the motivation, the identity, the coaching, the management, the ability to adapt. You know, they're not too proud to sit in a low block or to adjust to different types of teams that they might play. So I would say they've got a small handful of really talented players, the best in their position in the region, and then they've got all the intangibles and going in their favor.
So let's move on from the Canada game to the game that just will not go away, the game that was probably the most talked about game of World Cup qualifying. It continues to be relevant in the discourse for U.S. soccer. It was the game against, It was the game against Honduras. It was the game in Minnesota. It was the game that was played, one of the coldest soccer games ever played in North America. The U.S. ended up winning 3-0 in that game. It was a big performance for the U.S. Two Honduran players were pulled from that game. They said they had hypothermia. That's been discussed a lot. The Matt Turner frostbite gate has emanated from that game and is still relevant within the U.S. Men's National Team discourse. What do you remember from this game?
It really was that cold, to be honest. I've never been that cold in my entire life. And, you know, I can't imagine how the players feel. Generally speaking, you know, Minneapolis St. Paul is incredible. That was my first time there. So part of me is grateful for the opportunity to explore a really cool city. Maybe next time we play that match in a different time of the year. I think it's ridiculous that we went there. I don't think we needed to play the game there. I don't think we needed to have players that cold in order to beat Honduras. And it did put players in danger. It put players in danger from Honduras and from the United States men's national team. I mean, Reggie Cannon, do you remember the picture of his ear? It was like swollen after the game. That shouldn't happen. And when it comes to Matt Turner, after the Bruce Arena, so like you thought that it was just a rumor and then everything was put to bed and Matt Turner comes out with his comments and then Bruce Arena comes in and he's like, yeah, he had frostbite. And I reached out to U.S. Soccer after that. And I was like, does he have frostbite? And like linked the press conference. And they were like, Bruce isn't a doctor. He doesn't have frostbite, kind of thing. And so I mean, I'm just going to go with this whole thing is ridiculous. They shouldn't have played the game there. I do think that's the fault of U.S. Soccer. Did Matt Turner have frostbite? Who knows? Honestly, Bruce Arena says yes. It sounds like he had something caused from the cold. And I think that that's the fault of U.S. soccer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember listening to the Orange Slices podcast with Mark McKenzie and Heath Pierce after this game, and Heath was kind of pressing Mark about playing in the cold and how is it received in the locker room. And Mark, you know, he didn't come out and say it, but he kind of alluded to the fact that the players were not very happy about being put in that situation. And there was a lot of frustration there. And then later on, I forget where I heard it, but Greg alluded to this window and called it like the cold window and about how they had to overcome that adversity. And it was just another moment where so many people were like, you created that adversity. This was a choice you made. You didn't need to do that. There are warm parts of the United States you could have chosen. Anyway, let's move on because I think enough has been said about that particular window. Now, the last window, the March window, this was the business window for the U.S. men's national team. They go and play Mexico away at really interesting time. I mean, it was only a couple weeks after the Querétaro incident over in Mexico. That's not too far away from Mexico City in Estadio Azteca. There was a lot of frustration within the Mexican fan base. There were reports that, you know, fans were going to come to the game and do the chant just so that that Mexican Federation would get fined. We start the game and the stadium is not as full as we're used to. We don't get the atmosphere in Estadio Azteca that we're used to. It just kind of ends up being a game that, while it's going to be the last U.S. versus Mexico game in Estadio Azteca in World Cup qualifying for a while, it didn't feel like it had the intensity that we're used to in that match. But the U.S. ended up getting the job done. They get the 0-0 draw. Greg Berhalter ended up putting out the strongest lineup, and that was a big question coming in. What were your thoughts about the storylines and kind of everything going into Mexico City?
It's funny, things kind of came full circle a little bit. I think that they were all business in the last window. I think that they were still maintaining the focus of, we're taking this game by game. We have a job to get done. We need to get back to the World Cup. But I also think that they wanted to leave a mark. And I think that they were confident in the talent that they have on the team. And they were confident in being able to do something other teams hadn't done before. And I think as a team, even beyond Greg, I think they wanted that and want that still, whether or not they accomplished that necessarily in the last window. I think you see that in the fact that they wanted to go to Azteca, play the best lineup, and win. They wanted to be the first team to win in a World Cup qualifier in Azteca. They said as much, they wanted as much, they played that way. And the same in Costa Rica. After that, they wanted to go to Costa Rica and not just qualify by not giving up 6 goals. They wanted to go to Costa Rica and they did want to win. Whether or not they ended up getting that result is a different story. But I think in the last window, something that sticks with me is that this is a team that does believe in themselves and wants to keep pushing the ball forward. And yeah, they didn't get those results at Azteca or in San Jose, but I think it matters that they want that they want to not just qualify, but they do want to do it in style for all the critiques that they don't.
Now, this game will be remembered, I think, most fondly for that Gio Reyna run, where he just tore through the Mexican midfield and just put Hector Herrera on his face a couple of times. Now, I remember this game for the post-game press conference where Gio and Christian were both up there, and it seemed like it was just a lot of fun. Now, it sounded like they couldn't really hear the reporters, and there was a lot of confusion there. But I'm very curious about the relationship between Gio Reyna and Christian Pulisic. And we kind of got to see it in a way that we've never seen it before. Whereas Christian, you know, he came onto the scene and just had so much pressure and it feels like Christian really feels all of this in a really apparent way, in a really visible way. Whereas Gio is kind of this young superstar that seems sort of unfazed by everything going on around him. And it was really interesting to see the dynamic of these two players that have been compared so much and just so much has been written and said about the two. And we get to see them side by side and kind of how they interact. What did you feel from that press conference?
Yeah, another happy accident, actually. So it was a virtual press conference. And so we were still in the press box, which is an outdoors press box. So, you know, the commotion is still going on at Azteca. And we're sitting there with our headphones, not really quite able to hear them. And they're not really quite able to hear us. And they were the people working at Azteca wanted to get rid of us. They wanted us out of the stadium. So it was just a time constraint that had them going together. And those were the two players everybody had asked to talk to. So that's what had them together. And it is really cool, actually, in retrospect, to see the way they feed off of each other, and specifically those two, but players in general, it's cool to see them do those press conferences in pairs. I mean, yeah, it was a hilarious press conference in some ways. I like the way they react to each other and interact with each other. And I think that you really hit the nail on the head. I think Christian, for a number of reasons, because of the hype around him, because of the success that he's had, he has so much pressure put on him by the United States fan base and federation and everything to do with U.S. soccer. And he definitely feels that. I think he wants to deliver for that. And you see that pressure. He takes it very seriously. He also handles it well. I don't think he buckles beneath the pressure, but I do think he feels that pressure. Gio, I mean, even coming out of the locker room before the Costa Rica game, he's like down there with his headphones and he's like laughing with people. And, you know, he's got an aura around him where he's tenacious and he's really, you know, confident. But it seems like he's having just fun as well. And I think that comes out in the press conferences. I think that they've got different personalities and different energies on and off the field that work really well together. So it's exciting to see the way they can feed off of each other. And I think they've got clearly a lot. I think they all have a good relationship with one another. But I think the way that they talk about each other in that press conference, even though Pulisic wouldn't hype up Gio when he asked him to, you can tell that they have a lot of respect, and when they're asked about one another, they have a lot of really positive things to say.
Let's move on to the game in Panama, or the game against Panama in Orlando, where the U.S. Virtually clinched qualifying. Still a very tense moment heading into that game because so much was riding on that. The U.S. come out and just My read on things was that everything had been so hard throughout World Cup qualifying. There were so many half chances and chances that just, you know, we weren't getting it. In that game, everything just flowed right for the U.S. From getting that penalty early on, for getting those penalties early on, to like the Paul Areola header. I mean, everything just went the U.S.'s way. And it was like a huge celebration. And that felt, I felt that emanating through the stadium from both the players on the field and the fans in the stands. What do you remember about this game and that post-match press conference?
Yeah, I think it was a huge release of energy, really. I mean, it's like you said, sometimes when we're on, we're really on, and all of the players are working well together. I think certain pieces by that, I mean, thinking about the trajectory of players who weren't in the picture, slowly brought into the picture, like Luca Della Torre, I think was a huge part of that lineup in that last game. I think he played really well. I think he worked really well with Pulisic in certain ways. So I think individual performances and then overall team cohesive performances, it was just one of the best we've seen over the course of qualification. And then, like you said, you could feel the energy in the players and in the stands. It was just a celebration. We could feel, if not, you know, 100% certified, we could feel ourselves qualified that night. And I think that that was felt by the players and in the stands. And I think it was nice to have that in a home atmosphere, to be able to have the hat trick from Christian Pulisic, to have Paul Areola score, which I'm excited by. It's nice to see him score like that. Apparently he was injured when it happened as well. Jesus Ferreira as well with the goal. He's been someone who emerged over the course of qualifying, who I think will continue to be a key part of this team. So nice to see him score in that last match as well. So yeah, I mean, it was just a really solid performance. As always, there's things to clean up. I think players say that. I think they say that in the post-match. I think Greg says that. I think, you know, you see critiques from the fan base over how the team's has played in certain ways, even when we win. And I think a lot of the critiques are valid. And I would just say, I think the players know that even when they're celebrating, even after the Costa Rica game as well. I think they know where they need to clean up. And I have hope or faith that they will continue to, because there is a lot to still clean up moving forward into the World Cup.
Yeah, and you just brought something up that kind of jogged my memory. In this window, we got the comment from Walker Zimmerman where he talked about, you know, we don't care about what some fan in Nebraska has to say. What did you think about that? About that comment and about what that what do you think? Where do you think that came from?
Every now and then, I hope the players don't go on social media, but they probably all do. It depends on the personality type. I mean, and Paul Areola was asked as well, I think, in that post-match about getting hate from the fans and whether it feels good to have scored given that hate. And he had that like funny smile on his face answering that question. I mean, it's so hard to be an athlete, I think, in the modern era of social media. I think some players feed off of that. I forget what player it is in the NBA that he is it Kevin Garnett that he checks Twitter at halftime because it gets him fired up and then he goes out and has an amazing second half? Like, I kind of hope we have players out there like that on our team, but I don't know who exactly that would be. I think it shows that clearly he, as well as the team probably, but at least he specifically is aware of the critiques about how the team is playing or how he specifically is playing. And, you know, not caring about what one fan in Nebraska thinks. I think they care about how they're playing is the important part. I think he, in particular, and the team in general have made clear, especially in that last window, that they don't just want to qualify. They want to win in Azteca. They wanted to win in Costa Rica. They want to play that they want to play. So I don't think it's entirely true that they don't care how they look. But I think as a player, I mean, you can't care what some random fan in Nebraska is saying on Twitter. No disrespect to fans and no disrespect to Nebraska. But you have to be able to tune that out as a player. He did, I think it was after the Costa Rica game, he did say, like, my apologies to Nebraska. I shouldn't have, like, he's like, that was a slip of the tongue. He did say that. And I do think that he cares how they play, but you can kind of, I don't fault him for saying that. I think as a competitor, you have to be able to tune that out.
Yeah. It's an interesting discussion because there's been so much discussion about the fans and how the fans are behaving or how they should behave. And there's been critiques from Walker Zimmerman and from other bits of the media. And maybe we'll talk about that after the Costa Rica game. But let's get into the last game of World Cup qualifying. It was a Costa Rica game, kind of a weird situation. The U.S., all they needed to qualify was to not get beat by 6 goals. They go into Costa Rica. Costa Rica themselves is in a weird situation where they're looking to qualify for the playoff, basically. They have a lot of players on yellow cards that they opt not to start. They bring in a bunch of young players. The U.S. puts out a lineup that while they had logged a lot of minutes and had looked good throughout the first two games, they definitely showed the fatigue in Costa Rica. And the U.S. kind of gets humbled with a 2-0 defeat, but still has the party, still qualifies, still kind of happy and sad at the same time. What do you remember from this game?
I think it felt, I mean, weird is the word, because I think that from the U.S., as well as, I mean, not the players, they weren't celebrating before the game, but generally the atmosphere in San Jose, I walked from where I was staying to the game, just wanting to get the atmosphere. You know, the entire city was covered in Costa Rican jerseys and were celebrating. The stadium was celebrating. And it's funny because, you know, they didn't put out their starting lineup and they were, you know, they're headed to the playoff spot. And I think they knew that at that point. And that's kind of what they expected. And they were just celebrating. Last match of the cycle for them. We want to beat the U.S. because of pride, because they've never beaten us here before. But they were just celebrating an incredible comeback story for Costa Rica. I mean, we were writing them off in the first few windows, given their early performance. I think in the last 6 matches they played, they tied once and won the other 4 matches in the octagonal. So I think it was a celebration for them. They weren't playing necessarily to be in the top 3 spots. I don't think they were planning for scoring 6 goals. I mean, if it happened, great, but they had a good result. And I think that for the U.S., like I've said, and like the players were saying before going into that match, they were very focused. They were still taking it game by game. They weren't taking it for granted that they would qualify. They were very serious. You could sense that. We had a number of press conferences before that were published, and then also just for the media before that final game, and they all echoed the sentiment that they were very focused. They didn't take it for granted that they were qualified, but also, and I think interestingly, they were all saying that they wanted to not just qualify, they wanted to win. They wanted to be the first team to go to Costa Rica and win. So that was the mentality. I do think they were tired. I think, you know, things that went wrong, little mistakes that we'll get punished for at the World Cup showed up. I think it's disappointing to end on that note in a certain sense, but it's okay. I mean, I think we and they know that there's things to work out before the World Cup, and they did show up in that last game.
Now, I want to move on to some kind of overall observations. Let's start with the main man, Captain America. Let's start with Christian Pulisic. He's the player that had that iconic photo in Cuba after missing out on the last World Cup. I don't think that there's any player that was more affected by missing out on the World Cup than Christian Pulisic, because that would have been his World Cup coming out party. That would have been his introduction to the United States. That would have been his introduction to the world. He missed out on that. After that, I mean, he put out that that letter in the Players Tribune where he talked about how he wanted to fix that. And you could tell that it's something that he's carried with him this entire 4 years building up to this moment. Throughout World Cup qualifying, there's been a lot made about Christian Pulisic, about him not being the star for this team that everybody expected him to be. It felt like a really cathartic moment for him getting that hat trick against Panama and really getting, you know, he got the standing ovation and he got to walk off the field. And it felt like a really a moment of change for Christian Pulisic. And then after this game, he finally finishes the job. He qualifies the U.S. for the World Cup. What were your thoughts on kind of Christian Pulisic after that game and sort of this entire Christian Pulisic throughout World Cup qualifying?
I think with him, one of the biggest things is he needs to stay healthy. I think that he wasn't always present in World Cup qualification because of injuries or just coming back from injuries. But I think that when he's been here, he's made the impact. I still think he has what it takes to lead the team and be the guy for the team if he can stay healthy. I think that, like you said, probably he feels this on a more emotive level than anyone else on the team because he was there because it meant so much to him to not make it in the last World Cup. After the game ended, we were in the mix zone, the media, and a number of players were brought out to talk to us. Walker came out first, and you could see like Michael Kamerman would go in to try and like bring them out of the celebration. And like, it's probably a matter of who he can convince to leave the celebration and come talk to us or talk to us at all. So Walker comes first. Christian was the last to come out and talk to us. And I'd like to believe it was because he was in there celebrating. And
yeah, they showed in the video in the behind the crest that Christian definitely chugged a beer and then threw it down on the ground. So kudos to Captain America.
Yeah, I haven't watched this behind the crest. I'll have to do this after we're done. But yeah, he was the last to come out and took a little bit longer than pretty much everyone else was like on the bus. And I'd like to believe that's because he was celebrating longer. And I think that's probably why. I think this meant the most to him. Moving beyond what it means to him personally and him celebrating, I think that he had a number of really impressive performances over the course of qualification. And if he ever wasn't looking his best, I don't think it's necessarily on him. I think it's us working out a system or putting him in a position to do what he does best and or him coming back from injury. So yeah, there's been critiques or like, is he Captain America after all? I think we need to retire Captain America from our vocabulary personally. We love to do this. We do this with everybody who comes around. You know, it's like, who's the new savior? But I'd be interested to know. I wonder if anyone's ever asked him how he feels about the Captain America thing. But yeah, I wouldn't write him off as being that leader of the team. I think he's got what it takes. I think that he's still focused. And I think if anyone still has that hunger to perform at the World Cup and stay focused over the next, 7 months, I think it's him.
So there's a lot of narratives that have taken place throughout World Cup qualifying. I want to know, in your opinion, starting with that, you know, the first game in El Salvador all the way to the last game in Costa Rica, did you see growth in this team? Did you see a team that came together? Are you more confident going towards the World Cup now than you were in El Salvador?
I am, reservedly. I would say, I mean, has there been growth? Absolutely. There's been an incredible amount of growth in a few different directions. There's been growth in Greg. There's been growth in the team as a cohesive unit, figuring out how one another plays, learning to read each other's movements, reading to learn the cues and working in the system that Greg does have. I think we've seen that grow. We've seen it really work in places and not in others still. I think that this team really cares about each other. I think that they're all young. I think that they, a lot of them grew up together in the U.S. soccer system. I think that you can see how close they are. They call each other a band of brothers. I believe that. And I think that while they've had other games and they've had other big games, this was like the battle test for this band of brothers. And I think that they are stronger for having gone through this together. And I say reservedly because I think that there are big questions that we did have in September that we have now and that persisted over the course of qualification. And I hope that we can work on them before the World Cup because those questions will be asked of us in November, and we haven't come up quite with the solution just yet.
All right. So Meg, I think we went through every game. We went through it all. What are your kind of final overall thoughts on the window before we head out?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, as I've said a few times before, I think there's a lot to be excited about. I think we figured out a lot of things, whether it's specific players, bringing them into the system, making an impact on the team, or figuring out things cohesively together. I think there's been a lot of positive evolution. I also think that there's a lot to be figured out over the course of the next 7 months. I think keeping, you know, an eye on how all these players are doing at their clubs, whether that's domestically in MLS or abroad, is going to impact a lot of who's on that roster. And I'm excited to see who we're going to be playing outside of those two Nation League games in June. It sounds like we'll be away in El Salvador and then home against Granada in June. And then looks like we're going to play Uruguay maybe twice in June. And then I've heard murmurs about Argentina in September and one other. So yeah, I think there's a lot to be excited about, a lot to figure out. I think we can be excited about qualifying while knowing there's still some things that we need to work out as a team.
Absolutely. It's going to be a really fun 8 months with a lot of anticipation. And I can't wait for the country to get introduced to a lot of these guys. I think they're going to fall in love with this team and these players. And it's going to be really exciting for soccer moving forward. Meg, tell me or tell us where people can follow you and see your work.
Yeah, the easiest place to find me is on Twitter. I'm at Meg_Swanick. You'll see me in some other places. I have a YouTube channel in beta mode, which I reserve the right to revive at some point, but haven't yet. So look for me on Twitter, and that'll be the best place.
Guys, thank you so much for watching. For Meg Swanick, my name is Sam, and this is the Yank Report brought to you by Bet Online.